Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. We're continuing the chapter called The Third Exit Point from the Cycle, and this is related to the Third Noble Truth, the truth of the cessation of dukkha. The next section is called Peace Does Not Mean Passivity. Earlier in this book I quoted a poem, "Life is truly a dream. All of its troubles I alone create. When I stop creating, the trouble stops." So that's a short verse that was written by an American former monk, Bhikshu Hung Chao. He was one of the two. He was a novice at the time. He was a novice in the Northern Buddhist tradition, a disciple of Master Xuanhua, and he and Reverend Hung Shur, who was a bhikshu, they bowed every, took three steps in one bow all the way from Los Angeles to City of 10,000 Buddhas in Mendocino County. So that's about 500 or 600 miles. Took them 2 or 3 years to do, all the way through Los Angeles, which is a big area in its own right, all the way up Highway 1 on the Pacific Coast Highway to through San Francisco and then up into Mendocino County, about 120 miles north of San Francisco. So that's the same community that donated the land for Abhayagiri Monastery, where I lived for a long time. And so I know Hung Chao disrobed after a number of years. He's now a history professor at the university in the States. And this was a verse that he wrote when, I think when he was on that long bowing trip with Reverend Hung Shur, so that they had a lot of troubles along the way, a lot of things to negotiate with along the highway with trucks that would like to drive as close as they possibly could to them as they were bowing along, and friendly police officers, unfriendly police officers, bikers, all kinds of interesting encounters that they had along the way. Well, actually, one of the most impressive encounters was Hung Shur had taken a vow of silence, so Hung Chao was doing all the talking. and so this biker gang pulled up beside them, and this particularly large, sort of burly guy, leather clad with a big, you know, a big bushy beard, and he pulled up his bike next to Hung Chao, and he sort of took hold of the front of his robes and picked him up with one hand. And he's not a small guy. But Hung Chao is also a kind of karate expert, so he could handle himself too, but he didn't do anything aggressive. He just let himself be picked up, and this guy says, "What are you doing?" And he said, "We're bowing up the California coast for the sake of world peace." Put him down, fished out a great wad of fairly grubby dollar bill, you know, $20 bills and $50 bills, and shoved it on the front of his robe and said, "Cool." Revved up his bike and they rode off. And Hung Chao has kind of fished out this donation from the front of his robes. And okay. So we got some funds for a few days. So they had some interesting encounters. But, you know, life is truly a dream. All of its troubles I alone create. When I stop creating, the trouble stops. That doesn't mean that all of our debts are magically paid off or that our illnesses suddenly disappear. What it means is that the mind no longer creates a struggle, no longer creates trouble out of those experiences. That also does not mean that we are passive. We still go to the doctor if we're ill. We still do things to work with difficult issues. However, along the way, the mind does not create suffering out of any of those concerns. The arrows turn into flowers, perfume and beams of light, in the imagery of the Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree at the Enlightenment. Even if you're lying in bed in the hospice and it's the last minutes of your life, you're fine. This is what we mean by dukkha nirodha. Even when there is great pain, we can experience that pain but not create suffering out of it. This is how the Buddha encourages us to be. Pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional. So actually, I was invited to give a Dhamma talk today through the Angel Group based in Bangkok, and one of the themes I was talking about was how peace is not the same as passivity. And I appreciate that English is not the first language of everybody here, a fair proportion, but not everyone. So to be passive means to be deliberately not taking action, to allow things to happen to you, and to take a deliberately kind of a non-responsive, kind of numb stance in relationship to activity or engagement, and to deliberately choose kind of stillness or switching off or disconnecting. So peace in the Buddhist sense does not mean passivity. It doesn't mean not taking action or not responding. But oftentimes in Dhamma practice, also sometimes the way meditation teachings are presented, either verbally or in writings, when we talk about things like non-attachment or being the watcher, being the observer, that can be held to think, oh, I should just observe. So therefore, if the fire alarm goes off, I should just hearing. Or if the monk sitting next to us sort of keels over and has a seizure, it's like, hearing, seizuring. So that, I'm kind of being ridiculous, but kind of not being ridiculous, because sometimes that's the sort of instruction people feel they're supposed to follow. And that just kind of, and using that kind of a principle, just being the watcher, being the observer, or being the one who knows. And that one of the things I like to stress, and I was included in that talk today with the Angel Group, that our capacity to act is also part of the way things are. That it's not like we are some sort of abstracted thing outside of nature. We are part of nature. We are nature. And so just watching is also just watching yourself taking action when the monk next to you keels over and starts having a seizure. You watch yourself taking action. So that's also part of just watching. So it's a point I make very often, because it is regularly misunderstood. And because in a way, it's even when you're trying to be passive or quote unquote just watch, your choice to switch off and not do anything is actually a doing. your inaction is a doing. You're choosing to not respond. In a way, you're switching off your natural responsivity and your natural relatedness to the rest of the living system, the living world. So it's a on one level, I'm just watching, but no, you're deliberately switching off your innate relatedness, and so I feel is an important principle to understand and to get a feeling for. And there's various stories that are told about this, just the way that people are. I shouldn't do anything. I should just have faith. I should just trust that this is what I'm supposed to do, and things will work out all right. But it's our capacity to take action. When someone's having a seizure next to you, or there's a fire, the appropriate thing to do is to get up and leave the building, to help the person next to you who's just fallen over. You're using your natural, intuitive, and instinctive relatedness to the living system. One of the stories that's told as an example of this sort of ridiculous kinds of faith is that it's a story that's told many times where there's a huge flood happening, and this person's in their home, and the And the floodwaters are rising and rising, and they go up to the upper story, and the floodwater keeps rising, and they go up to the attic, and the floodwater keeps rising, and they climb out of the skylight and onto the roof, and all the way along. I said, well, I have great faith in the Lord. God will provide. If I pray hard enough, then I'll be okay. And so the floodwaters have arisen, and this person's sitting on the roof of their house thinking, well, I'm praying really hard, and God will provide. And then there's a rescue boat comes along and says, please, please get in the boat. We're picking up everyone in this area. That's all right, I'm fine, God will provide. I'm okay. And then they said, were you sure? He said, yeah, I'm fine. I'm sure God will look after me. And then that boat goes off, and then another one comes along, about half an hour later, saying, please get on board, you're the last of the people in this area. So I'm fine, God will provide. And the water gets higher and higher, and it's almost up to the ridge, and this fellow's sitting on the ridge of the house thinking, dear Lord, I have great faith in you, please help. And then a helicopter comes along and drops down a ladder and said, get on board, you're going to go under any minute. Says, I'm all right, God will provide. And then they say, you're really in danger here. Please get on board. Just grab the ladder, and we'll rescue you. I'm fine. God will provide. Then the water rises up, and the guy drowns, and then arrives at the pearly gates, and it's a bit disgruntled. I say, I had great faith. I trusted in the Lord, and I turned away a couple of boats and a helicopter, but still I drowned. And then, so, how come? This is really unfair. I thought I was demonstrating great faith. And then St. Peter at the gate says, I've got a message from the Lord. He said, I sent you two boats and a helicopter. Why didn't you get on board? So if I may borrow that from a different tradition. There's another one, actually, a very similar story from the Indian tradition about a chela who has great faith in their guru, and the guru will look after everything. I have great faith in the guru will always protect. So this person is walking down a street, and this elephant goes crazy and is charging down the street, and the mahout on top of the elephant is saying, get out of the way, the elephant's out of control. And this disciple is standing in the street saying, no, Guruji will look after me. Guruji, he said, I will always be protected if I'm a faithful disciple. And then the elephant's getting closer and closer, get out of the way, I'm out of control. And then he said, I'm fine. Guruji said, I'll always be protected. And then gets knocked over by the elephant, and the disciple crawls along to the ashram. Says, Guruji, I have great faith in you. And this elephant came down the street and said, I can see. And he said, well, you said that if I was your faithful disciple, I'd always be protected. And he said, well, didn't you hear me shouting through the mahout, get out of the way? Why didn't you listen? So again, neither of those stories are absolutely perfect, but they demonstrate it's a passivity or faith based on foolishness can have painful results. So similarly, if we take an instruction like, well, the Ajahn said, just be the observer, be the watcher, and we are watching as we experience the ligaments in our knee breaking up, or the discs in our knees or our back kind of popping out. Oh, I'd said I'd sit here for 2 hours and investigate the pain, but all the signals you're getting is this is too much. My knees are breaking up. This is causing permanent damage. Well, I'm just going to watch, and then you have to be carried out of the meditation hall. That is not a fantasy either. That kind of thing has happened in this community in the past, and the person thinking, oh, I was just watching the pain, but you weren't actually just watching. There was also a switching off. And, it's well intentioned to endure a painful feeling, but also the intuitive sense, the body's own intelligence is saying, this is enough. You're stretching things beyond what the system can tolerate. This is gonna have painful consequences. And then people wrecking their knees, their joints, and taking a long, long time for them to recover on account of well-intentioned zealousness, but not not receiving or not paying attention to the other signals that the body is putting out. But not causing any insult to anyone sitting on chairs. this is part of the quality of peace is that action is not an intrusion upon peace. Action, choice, decision making, when it's in tune with Dhamma, doesn't disturb peace. It's not an intrusion on the universe. It's not something that's upsetting the way things are. When action, decision, choice is in tune with Dhamma, then decisions are made. You know, you change your posture, or you adapt to a situation, not out of weakness or impatience or lack of resolution, but because the intuitive sense, this is the time to move. This is, there's an offer to help from a boat or a helicopter. Okay, get on the boat, time to go. I wanted to sit here for 2 hours without moving. The message I'm getting from my body is, it's time to move. I had that resolution, and maybe it was well-intentioned, but the signals I'm getting from the body are, it's time to move, so let's move and work on my Adhidhamma Paramita a different way, or on a different occasion. So this is a significant principle, and I also wanted to read the story of the end of Anathapindika's life, which is found in Sutta 143, the advice to Anathapindika in the middle-length discourses, because it also relates to physical pain and the end-of-life experience. So Anathapindika was a great, very wealthy and generous donor. He provided the land and also the initial buildings for the Jetavana monastery. And at this point, he's quite ill, and so this is somebody who's a friend of his goes to the Buddha, and a friend of Anathapindika is asked to go to the Buddha and saying, "Please, venerable sir, the householder Anathapindika is afflicted, suffering, and gravely ill. He pays homage with his head at the Blessed One's feet. Then go to the Venerable Sariputta, pay homage in my name with your head at his feet, and say, Venerable Sir, the householder Anathapindika is afflicted, suffering, and gravely ill. Then say, it would be good, Venerable Sir, if the Venerable Sariputta would come to the residence of the householder Anathapindika out of compassion. So Venerable Sariputta goes to visit Anathapindika on his sickbed. Then Sariputta goes to see him, and in a friendly way, he says, householder, I hope you're getting well. I hope you're comfortable. I hope your painful feelings are subsiding and not increasing. And that they're subsiding, not their increase, is apparent. And with in a very dry manner and very polite, Anathapindika says, Venerable Sariputta, I am not getting well. I am not comfortable. My painful feelings are increasing, not subsiding. Their increase and not their subsiding is apparent. Just as if a strong man was splitting my head open with a sharp sword, so too, violent winds, energies cut through my head. I'm not getting well. Just as if a strong man were tightening a tough leather strap around my head as a headband, so too, there are violent pains in my head. And so on and so forth. So then Venerable Sariputta gives him a Dhamma talk about reflecting on the six senses and not clinging to the eye, the ear, the nose, the body, and the mind. And at the end of this Dhamma talk, again, you can read this yourself, Sutta 143 in the Majjhima Nikaya. It gives this thorough discourse about recognizing each of the six senses and letting go of aspects of clinging, with respect to the six senses, also with respect to the four elements, with respect to the five khandhas. It's like don't cling, kind of to any of this, and then even to the refined states of consciousness, like infinite space, infinite consciousness, neither perception nor non-perception. And he finishes with, householder, you should train thus. I will not cling to this world, and my consciousness will not be dependent on this world. I will not cling to the world beyond, and my consciousness will not be dependent on the world beyond. Thus you should train. Householder, you should train thus. I will not cling to what is seen, heard, sensed, cognized, encountered, sought after, and examined by the mind, and my consciousness will not be dependent on that. Thus you should train. When this was said, the householder Anathapindika wept and shed tears. And the Venerable Ananda, who was along there as well, said, oh, are you foundering, householder? Are you sinking? And then Anathapindika replies, I'm not foundering. I'm not kind of desperate or in pain, Venerable Ananda. I am not sinking, but although I have long waited upon the teacher and bhikkhus worthy of esteem, never before have I heard such a talk on the Dhamma. He says, such talk on the Dhamma, householder, is not given to lay people clothed in white. Such talk on the Dhamma is usually given to those who have gone forth. Well then, Venerable Sariputta, let such talk on the Dhamma be given to lay people clothed in white. There are clansmen with little dust in their eyes who are wasting away through not hearing such talk on the Dhamma. There will be those who will understand the Dhamma. Then, after giving the householder Anathapindika this advice, the Venerable Sariputta and Venerable Ananda rose from their seats and departed. Soon after they had left, the householder Anathapindika died and reappeared in the Tusita heaven. Then he appears as a deva to the Buddha later that night, and then announces that he has been appreciative of the Buddha's teaching, and he's reappeared in the Tusita heaven. So that is, I think, very interesting that even though he had so much kind of misery and pain, kind of extreme difficulty in having that instruction on not clinging in all these many and various ways, then the tears he sheds are not because of his head being feeling like it's being split open and such like, but the tears are tears of joy at receiving these teachings that are helping to establish a very skillful attitude. He doesn't complain about his illness. I'm not getting well. I'm not comfortable. My painful feelings are increasing. But his mind is not making a problem out of that. And what's a source of joy and delight, his tears are from the delight in receiving these Dhamma teachings and really appreciating hearing such profound Dhamma just before his passing away. So there's a few items there. Please, any questions, thoughts, reflections? Of course, it would help to have two great beings coming to visit you on your deathbed. but still, I feel that's the example of that even if in a lot of physical pain, my pains are increasing, not decreasing. Still, what makes a difference is being able to change the attitude, and the teachings were a catalyst for that shift of view, and able to help the mind to be not dependent on the six senses or the four elements or the five khandhas, any of these aspects of experience. Thoughts, feelings? Okay, so to continue. So the next section is called Sensory Experience Leading to Nibbana. Dependent origination is only one way of describing the process, the development of an experience. It represents the process of experience affected by ignorance, when the mind is not awake and not seeing clearly. However, there's also the possibility of experiencing things through a fully awake mind. In the Anguttara Nikaya, the numerical discourses, the Buddha gives a description of the process of experience which is free from ignorance. It begins with interest, chanda. All things are rooted in interest. With interest, chanda, as the root, then all things are born of attention, manasikara. Then there is contact, pasa, so that bringing attention to looking at, say, the carpet, rooted in interest, born of attention, so the attention resting on that object, and pasa, the sense contact, the light entering the eye and then registering in consciousness, eye consciousness, as that's the sense contact. And then from that contact, There's the paying of attention. This is the paying of attention to the present. The mind turns toward that sense contact, and from that contact, feeling, Vedana, arises. That feeling can be pleasant, painful, or neutral. The Buddha uses the phrase diverging into feelings, or converging on feelings, Vedana Samosarana. You can use the image of a tree to picture this process. Interest is at the root, attention is where the roots come together and the trunk arises from the ground. Contact, pasa, is like the trunk. When the branches spread out, this is the spreading of feelings, diverging into feelings. And so when I was putting this book together, I created a little picture of a tree. I can possibly add this to the graphic display here on the wall, but page 137. It's just, again, it's my own diagram. It's not something that you find in classical Buddhist texts, but it's just a handy aid memoir for myself, or how it sort of takes shape in my mind, and as a tree with the fruit, kind of apples hanging off the branches. Then significantly, in contrast to dependent origination, instead of feeling, Vedana, leading to craving and clinging and so on, in this case, the mind has a very different relationship to feeling. You can envision the next three steps in the sequence as the big branches turning into smaller branches and then into twigs. The next three links are headed by concentration, samadhi, then dominated by mindfulness, sati, and surmounted by wisdom, panya. So headed by concentration, dominated by mindfulness, surmounted by wisdom. Concentration, mindfulness, and wisdom. Concentration focuses the attention. Mindfulness brings awareness of how the feeling is changing and the context of the feeling. And wisdom recognizes that the nature of all feelings is anicca, dukkha, anatta, impermanent, unsatisfactory, impersonal. The mind is fully awake and aware. All varieties of feeling are attended to, and the mind is in tune with them. The mind is not drawn into grasping the pleasant or opposing the painful. The mind sees feelings in their true light and holds them in an environment of mindfulness and wisdom, satipanya. The mind is attuned to their nature. And then the next phase of that process, this is in the Book of the Tens, Sutta number 58, Anguttara 10:58. All things yield deliverance as their essence. You can imagine the fruit that grows on our beautiful tree. It's covered with in the fruits of deliverance, vimutti, liberation. Every feeling that has been known and understood, whether pleasant or unpleasant or neutral, bears the fruit of liberation. The next link is merging in the deathless, amatogadha. All things merge in the deathless. Following the image of our beautiful tree, the tree covered in the fruits of liberation, then merging in the deathless is represented by all of the branches and twigs and leaves and fruit being surrounded by and merged with the atmosphere, the air. Finally, all things terminate in nibbana. Terminating in nibbana are all things. The Buddha described all of this in order to help us to develop a skillful way of recognizing our experience and seeing how things work in the light of wisdom. What is the process of experiencing when the mind is awake? So, and in my little picture of the tree, you got the deathless represented by the atmosphere, the air around the tree, and then it's difficult to depict it, but nibbana, the arrows are kind of pointing out to you, the reader. So they're pointing out of the page. You haven't got a really 3D. Maybe if on a screen you could do a kind of a 3D representation, but it's like the terminating in nibbana is terminating in the mind that's reading this book or looking at this picture. That if the attitude is, say, appropriately in tune with Dhamma, and then the result is peacefulness. The Buddha described all of this in order to help us to develop a skillful way of recognizing our experience and seeing how things work in the light of wisdom. What is the process of experiencing when the mind is awake? This guidance is a way of informing our meditation, informing our practice. When we use words like merging in the deathless, there's an easy way to understand that. We recognize that what we took to be a thing, quote-unquote, was only given solidity by our attitude. We gave it reality by the way we attended to it. Merging in the deathless is recognizing that the apparent solidity, the perception of thingness, was imparted to the flow of experience by a mistaken attitude. There was no absolute thing that was born, and there is no thing that dies. So before I go on, there's a lot there in that. Any questions, thoughts? Yes.
Specifically in interrelational conflict, where's the point of passive, so in avoiding engagement with interpersonal, so if you've got an afflictive relationship with someone in the community, mm-hmm. at which point is not engaging with it passive, and at which point is it skillful? So there's a point where it's like, oh, there might be suppression, or maybe having a conversation might be the most skillful thing to do, and or there might be, often is the case, one person wants to talk about something and another doesn't. Mm-hmm. So one will think the other one's being passive or avoidant, passive or avoidant, the other will see it as skillful. That seems to be a really tricky sort of grey area where, yeah, is there a kind of, is that just down to work it out between you?
That's kind of it. Yeah. Every situation is unique. And also it's where the element of mindfulness and full awareness, sati sampajanya, wise reflection comes into it. Like, so weighing up the situation, like, well, I feel like the Buddha said not to associate with fools, but to associate with the wise. Well, yeah, he's foolish, so keep away from him. Well, okay, that's what I could take that stance, but there is perhaps something that would be good to talk about. So. Now, what's my motivation for talking about it? Do I want to set that person straight so I'll be happy? Or is the motivation that person's causing themselves a lot of difficulty, not just with me, but with all sorts of other people? So would it be helpful to let them know that the way they're acting is creating this kind of conflict? So first of all, to check your own motivation and to, you know, see where you're coming from. And my rule of thumb is, if I want you to be different so that I will be happy, then leave it. If it necessarily has to include the other person, so that it's like, is it for their benefit as well as just making me feel better or more comfortable? So that is useful, important if that's part of it. And then weighing up the situation, you say, okay, well, it seems like it'd be a good idea to mention this area with this person. So let's see if we can find a convenient moment, or maybe there'll be a time when things come up. And so that you can look at it that way, or you can recognize, okay, well, this other person, is, you know, we've had a bit of a clash, so that if I go anywhere near this person, you know, alarms go off. So, but they're good friends with this other person. So if she talks with him and says, oh, you know, Deepa would like to have a chat sometime, you know, what do you think? then that might be an entry point. Well, what does she want to talk about? Oh, well, you know, it's just thought it'd be helpful. So you can approach through a connector or a friend or an intermediary. And then if that leads to possibility of a conversation, okay. If it leads to more division, okay, well, you learn from that. And so every such situation, you can't generalize. So weighing things up with that mindfulness and wisdom, mindfulness and full awareness, and not presuming that just because you think your interpretation of a situation is one way, but that somebody else's interpretation might be very different. So to be weighing things up and considering, okay, well, it looks like this way for me, is that the whole story? Are there other perspectives on it? And so, again, another helpful way of if you've had a clash with somebody, then if you go to someone who's a friend, or you know, you get on well with, and say, well, I've had this clash with so-and-so, and it seemed to be about this particular issue. Am I getting something wrong? Or how does that look to you? Did you know about that? Can you let me know if I'm seeing this, if I've only got half the information, or I'm seeing this wrong? How does it look to you? So you're just getting a bit of input from others who are saying, well, yes, I fully agree with you. I've been thinking about that for the last week myself. So, okay, this does seem to need addressing. Or they might say, what are you talking about? Really? Oh, it doesn't seem that way to me at all. And you go, oh, really? No, just that's not how I've seen things. Oh. So just getting a bit of feedback from a sympathetic source is also very helpful. Yeah, in the past, when I've had those sort of strange encounters or challenging encounters, then, you know, I literally sort of after having some kind of, you know, eye-opening exchange, then one of the other monks who was there came up to me and said, can we have a reality check? I think I just heard, you know, XYZ. Did you hear that? And I said, I did. So I wasn't dreaming. I said, no, I heard that too. I said, oh, okay, thank you. Because of, like, somebody made like a really kind of outrageous assertion or accusation or whatever. So that just checking in with people whose work, you know, perspective you can trust, and then using your as much mindfulness and wisdom as you can draw upon.
Would it be fair to say that the path of non-conflict, but non-talking it out is a relatively safe way, as opposed to the sort of, let's talk about this, you know, every time?
Well, you can overshare and over-engage, but you can under-engage, and then things can fester. You know, that the Buddha said that rain soddens that which is covered up, but that which is open to the air, you know, the rain does not cause to rot. So just not talking about things or feeling like that's a forbidden subject, you can't talk about that. Often that, in the long run, that doesn't help. And so some way of letting it be known that or addressing what you're feeling. Now, this feels really off, or it doesn't feel skillful at all. And finding some way, at least sharing that with a sympathetic ear, someone that you can connect with and who won't be intimidated or challenged by that, just to say, this is what I mean. Like that conversation I had about this sort of the eye-popping comments. one of my brother monks. It's like, just to say, you know, that's what I heard, or that's what it looked like to me. What did it look like to you? So, again, you know, a problem shared is a problem halved. And just sometimes that recognition of, yeah, this is difficult, or yeah, this is really weird, I'm not sure what we're going to do about this. But then, you know, there's a sense of support there. You're not just sort of burying it or keeping it completely hidden, but it's something that is being addressed. But the thing to be most guarding against is coming from a reactive place, where you see something's really off. That's really bad. You know, he shouldn't do this. Or she did that again. Kind of jumping in and reacting. And that almost always has a negative, painful results. So at least some degree of responsivity, like, oh, well, I didn't like that, did I? Like, ooh. That pushed my buttons, you know, and and then at least some kind of a buffer whereby, right, well, what do I do with that, rather than reacting and just coming straight out with some kind of comment or without any kind of consideration. Sometimes there isn't much time to play with, but just some degree of responsivity, whether like, oh, you know, that was, you know, that was really exciting, or that's really frightening, or that's really irritating. And then knowing just that mental state that it's arisen, and seeing there's a reaction going on. Because if we just follow a reaction of liking or disliking or fear, whatever it might be, then in that moment the mind is giving that a false solidity. It's making, that's a real thing, that really is a problem, that really is attractive, that's really good, or that's really really worrying. And it's given that solidity by our attitude, and that reactive habit makes it a real thing, really attractive or really dangerous or really really off. And the qualities of mindfulness and wisdom doesn't mean that we don't take action or do something, but it's saying that's a strong reaction in the face of that event or that what just happened. And that amount of space around it helps there to be a skillful response, a skillful way of relating to it, rather than just the mind is recognizing this is an event, this is a ripple in the experiential field just happened, you know, a big loud one, but it's not solid, it can't be something that's absolutely real. And that's the element that allows there to be a kind of a mindful and appropriate connection with it. So to continue, there's just another page or so here. Ajahn Chah put it this way: all the things of this world are merely conventions of our own creation. Having established them, we get lost in them, giving rise to all kinds of trouble and confusion. That's the opening passage of a talk called Convention and Liberation, in case you're interested. One of the great statements. I think you could just take those two sentences and sit on them for a month. All the things of this world are merely conventions of our own creation. Having established them, we get lost in them, giving rise to all kinds of trouble and confusion. So, if we take a principle like merging in the deathless, quote unquote, it is really just seeing the empty nature of all things. It is simply seeing the dependent and conditioned nature of all things. Ajahn Chah also said that we determine things into existence. The last link is, quote, terminating in nirvana, unquote. Reflecting on the image of the tree, if the air represents the deathless, we can wonder, what is the symbol of nirvana? Then it came to my mind that since nirvana has no form at all, perhaps the terminating in nirvana, quote unquote, is the peace-filled awareness of this mind, knowing the image. This is where it terminates, in this very heart. This is where the image arises and passes away, where these words and forms are being contemplated. If that ending is clearly seen, if the empty nature of all things is clearly seen, the result of that seeing is great peacefulness, and that is the primary nature of nibbana, peace. We can be staying in a place that looks like paradise, such as Provence in the spring, which is where a lot of these I was in Provence for a lot of these a lot of the material of this book. There's this south of France in the springtime, you know, surrounded by beautiful green fresh spring leaves and the fragrance of lavender and all those good things. Provence, south of France, in the springtime. We can be staying in a place that looks like paradise, such as Provence in the spring, or a tropical garden in Chiang Mai, which is where I gave some of the other talks. Not to make anyone envious or jealous. Or anything. You know, Hertfordshire in a grey March day is also part of the experiential field. A tropical garden in Chiang Mai, surrounded by beautiful countryside and noble friends. Probably all of us have noticed at certain times that even when surrounded by wholesome, beautiful, noble and inspiring things, the mind can still create suffering. Is that the case? Again, just guesswork. We can be in paradise but still make ourselves miserable. When we look at the cycle of dependent origination, we see that things can end painfully. Or, with a skillful attitude, they can end very beautifully. Ajahn Sumedho summed this up in a very clear way. If you start with ignorance, you end up with dukkha. If you start with awareness, you end with nibbana. Or more briefly, quote, ignorance complicates everything, unquote. So that was a teaching here, right here in the Salem, when he was leading the winter retreats here in the late 80s, early 90s. Used the theme of dependent origination many, many times over. And that was his way of, describing the avijja paccaya sankhara, his sort of rendering of avijja paccaya sankhara, ignorance conditions formations. He would sum it up as ignorance complicates everything. That is the simple version. The work and practice of Dhamma is then to arouse and sustain the quality of awakened awareness. The more the heart is able to sustain this quality of awakened awareness and wisdom, the more the heart can be completely in tune with the reality of the present experience. This attunement conditions the realization of Nibbana, peacefulness. We bring attention to and sustain it on the present reality. This is the work that we all need to do if we wish to free the heart and realize peacefulness. And then I just quote that that little sutta, Sutta 58 in the Book of the Tens. Rooted in interest are all things, born of attention are all things, arising from contact are all things, diverging into or converging onto feelings are all things, headed by concentration are all things, dominated by mindfulness are all things, surmounted by wisdom are all things, yielding deliverance as their essence are all things, merging in the deathless are all things, terminating in Nibbana are all things. It's also maybe worth mentioning that those of you who've done retreats with Goenkaji, probably quite a few of you, so his focus on Vedana, on feeling, as I understand it, is informed very strongly by this particular teaching, and that converging on feelings, Vedana Samosarana, converging on all feelings, or diverging into feelings are all things. So that, as I understand it, was a key teaching in the mind of Goenkaji, and also why where we have in the dependent origination cycle that Vedana conditions Tanha, and as I was saying with the second exit point from the cycle, that bridge between feeling and craving, that's the key point for attention, that's why Vedana feeling is by some, not just Goenkaji, but many, many teachers point to mindfulness of feeling. That's the key point. So that in this particular teaching, this Sutta 58 of the Book of the Tens, the first part of it, rooting the interest, attention, contact, that's the then leading up to feeling, that's the sort of the structure of experience, and then working with that experience is by concentration, mindfulness, and wisdom, and then the result of that is deliverance, merging in the deathless, and Nibbana. But the setup, again, Vedana is the key point. It's where the setup meets the attitude of working with the experiential field. So it's also, Vedana is a key point within this. But if that whole process is based upon Vijja, upon awakened awareness, then when the contact has led to feeling, pleasant feeling, painful feeling, neutral feeling, then headed by concentration, dominated by mindfulness, surmounted by wisdom, then the result is Nibbana. If the feeling is based upon, or is heavily conditioned by ignorance, avijja, then you get to tanha, upadana, bhava, jati, soka, parideva, dukkha, dominas, upayasa, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair. Dukkha is the result. Any questions, thoughts, comments? Yes.
Merging in the deathless.
Amat Ogada. So, merging in the deathless are all things. So, it's an interesting phrase. It has been interpreted as like the same kind of languaging of say the Atman sort of dissolves or is absorbed into the Brahman, in Vedanta, or actually the way that the long poem The Light of Asia ends with the phrase, the dewdrop slips into the shining sea, like the little self dissolves into the big self. So that merging in the deathless is sometimes taken in that same kind of imagery. But I would say that's mistaken. And there's actually, in the book that Ajahn Pasano and I did about Nibbana called The Island, there's a whole little section I do on that phrase about merging in the deathless. So rather than the Atman dissolving into Brahman, or the dewdrop slipping into the shining sea, or becoming, you know, me becoming one with everything, the image I use to try and explain it is that it's more like the illusion dissolves and the reality of things is revealed, so that all things merge in the deathless, so that the mind that comes out of a dream state merges with waking reality. It's not like there was a separate identity or a separate thing that then dissolves into the sea of the deathless, or it's rather more like a dream that dissolves, and then the mind wakes up to the true reality of the apparent reality of the waking life. It's not a perfect image, but it's trying to go. The Buddha was quite specific in not going along with that Vedic model of the Atman dissolving into Brahman, but rather the illusion of things is what ends, that all things merge in the deathless. Amatogada is the Pali. Amatogada. Amat is deathless. Ogada is to merge or to dissolve. And it's a phrase that is used quite a few times in the Pali canon, in different teachings. So that was the best I could come up with, is rather than the self dissolving into sort of me becoming one with everything, or the ego dissolving into or becoming merged with a greater reality, is coming out of a dream and the true reality being recognized.
Is it because merging and dissolving? It seems very different. Like merging isn't like, it seems like, for me, because my English is not so good, but imagine just transforming. So is it dissolving?
Well, merging is, if I took some sugar and then stirred it up, then you could say the sugar has dissolved in the water, or that the sugar molecules have merged with the water. You could use quite validly. You could use both terms.
But it seems like merging. There is still the reality is still there. The mundane reality is still there with the Nibbana.
So that's it depends on how you think of the words, but it's like the merging in the deathless is you're seeing the empty or transparent nature of what seemed to be a solid independent thing, like a person or a carpet or a glass. That merging in the deathless is to recognize, oh, that the thingness that the mind gives to it can only be relative. It's not, there's not absolutely anything there. There never was any solid, permanent, independent thing there.
It's not reaching Nibbana. It's more like...
words are used in slightly different ways. It's kind of... mostly it's used to be the same kind of thing, or very closely related to Nibbana. But in that sequence, it's two different things. You have merging in the deathless are all things, then terminating in Nibbana. So that experience of peacefulness is the end result of that seeing of the empty nature. So having seen that a thing, all things merge in the deathless, that they, having seen that they are, they're intrinsically empty, then the feeling in the heart is peacefulness. Like, ah. Nibbana is a description of a feeling of peacefulness. It's not a, a place or a...
Is a feeling?
It's a description of a feeling, the feeling of peacefulness, coolness.
It's not a place.
There's another section in the island that also says that Nibbana is actually, the heading is Nibbana is not a place. There's a, the in from the Milinda part, the questions of King Milinda, there's a whole section of it is called Nibbana is not a place. It's really, really quite skillfully talked about. It's well, it doesn't say, yeah, Nibbana is Vedana, but it's a description of a peaceful quality that is knowable by the mind.
Yeah, I cannot imagine.
Huh?
I cannot imagine. So maybe.
As you wish. That's how. If you're interested, there's a whole 400-page book that we did on Nibbana. That's how I feel it's most skillful. It's a description of an experience. And that its primary quality is peacefulness. Yeah, the words are naturally limited. They can only be, a convenient fiction. They can point to the reality of things, but they can't really contain or fully embody the reality of things. But yeah, anyway, if you take a look, if you want to, in the book The Island, and then there is a section about that very phrase, about merging in the deathless. So if that brings up more questions in your mind, then please ask them. But take a look, because it's to me it's interesting that the Buddha was he was very conscious of the philosophies of his time, and he very deliberately didn't talk about a true self or a real self, and that his teaching was all about what is not self, what is not atta, anatta, and the model of the Atman sort of going through its sort of evolution or passing from one life to another, and then when spiritual evolution has come to its fulfillment, then the Atman dissolves into Brahman, the small self dissolves into the kind of universal reality. He very deliberately didn't use that model. He didn't talk in those ways, and so. Then taking a phrase like merging in the deathless, then it's important to pick it up and to sort of contemplate. Okay, so merging with the deathless, what does deathless mean? What is merging? To use your own meditation to explore those things. So in the past, I've done that a lot, just with coming across different aspects of the teaching, often listening to Dhamma talks by Lumpur Sumedho. Or these, particularly that all those years he was giving explanations about dependent origination, then I'd literally take a word or a couple of words and say, okay, avijja paccaya sankhara, so ignorance complicates everything. So avijja, not vijja. So what is that as a your own within your own experience, or how does that? How does the mind feel that or know that? And then sometimes when you pick up a particular word or a phrase, then I would find, I haven't got a clue what that means. what does that mean? So, or like sankhara, volitional formations. I remember, volitional formations, what the heck is that? like a phrase you'd never ordinarily use in English language, in ordinary household conversations. You got any volitional formations around here? It's like no one. It's not a phrase that you would ever use in ordinary English. What does that mean? Volitional formations. So a formation, okay, a volition, okay, but a volitional formation. So a thing that you've decided to make, or a thing made of your deciding, your ability to decide, or what? So I would sort of take a word like that and just reflect on it and explore it. And for a long time, it would just be like, nope, don't really know what that means, don't have a feeling for it. But then over time, as you practice with particular teachings or terminology and you see how it's used in different places, then slowly you begin to get a feel for how what things refer to. It's a, what we would call a contemplative process, to sort of pick things up and explore. And Ajahn Chah's style of practice and his style of teaching is very much that sort of picking things up, exploring, see how things work, and then finding analogies or comparing them with things in the world that he knew and understood to get a sense for how things fit, how they work. And then the teaching and the practice, it really... it's not just a set of words or ideas, but there's a much more of a feeling for how things function, and then you become much more able to use those teachings and practices from personal experience. You know what it's referring to. It's not just an idea or a set of words, but you have you can connect that to your own. Your own experience. Okay, well, that was the end of that chapter, so let's leave it there for today.
Sadhu.